Michael, I know you've been following absolutely every development out of Paris Fashion Week.
Always.
Well, Messika, one of our favorite high jewelry houses, celebrated its 20th anniversary with a spectacular show at the Musée des Arts Décoratifs.
That's a very cool idea for a jewelry designer. What was it like?
Well, it's actually their fifth show. They even had a special opening performance by Youssef Nador for the occasion. The collection was inspired by Southern Africa and showcased an array of colored stones, a first for Messika. The jewelry was shown on models who walked the runway, and some were wearing pieces that were designed in collaboration with fashion designers Feben and Vignate.
Sounds like a wonderful way to celebrate for founder Valérie Messika, who launched her brand back in 2005. And a star group of guests, including Carla Bruni, Eva Herzegova, were there to take it all in.
Indeed. Learn more and experience the high jewelry collection at Messika.com. Happy Saturday. It's October 25th, 2025, and you are listening to Morning Meeting. I'm Ashley Baker in New York.
And I'm Michael Haney, also in New York.
And we are two of your airmail editors, and we are here to share the news with you. Once again, we struggle to know where to begin, but let's go straight to the tabloids because you need to know what's going on with Meghan Markle. She has just parted ways with her 10th publicist in the past 5 years. The most recent one, who was poached from Netflix, quit after just 3 months. I wonder why. Meanwhile, in Washington, thanks to Trump, the East Wing of the White House has been demolished to make way for his $300 million ballroom. And last week, it was tariffs and now it's sanctions. Trump is decided to make Russia pay for its bad behavior in the war in Ukraine by sanctioning two of its largest oil companies. As usual, airmail and Morning Meeting are the antidote to all of the distressing news of the day.
Yeah, you know, first, Donald Trump has made it clear he doesn't much care for refugees from Asia, Africa, the Middle East, Latin America, or pretty much anywhere in the world. But as our co-editor, Alexander Stanley, notes, his contempt for those seeking refuge now extends all the way to Russian dissidents. She'll tell us what that means for all of us. Then, John von Soten has a great yarn this week. He'll reveal how and why one of the great masterpieces of Western art has been sequestered inside a convent in remote Canada for more than 200 years. It's a story you don't want to miss. So Ashley, where would you like to begin today?
Well, let's bring on Alessandra Stanley. She's the co-editor of Airmail and a Russia expert. She was the Moscow bureau chief for the New York Times, and she's here to shed some light on exactly what ICE is doing and why he's depositing these dissidents back into the hands of the Russians that they had fled. Alessandra Stanley, you're welcome.
Hello.
Okay, Alessandra, I had no idea that ICE is even more nefarious than we thought it was. I mean, apparently these people are going after the Russians. How did that happen?
Well, it's been happening all along. It's just that under Trump, they've found ways to deport people that normally would get a lot of consideration. And these people are mostly, you know, Russians who can't go home, right? Because they either deserted from the Putin's army or they are openly against him and dissenters who are wanted by the former KGB. And they're returning them right back to the airport where they escaped from so that intelligence agents can just arrest them and put them in the new Gulag 2.0.
I mean, how many are we talking about? And what does that look like when they get deposited at the airport? Is it as bad as it sounds?
We don't know how many, but it can be hundreds, and they're not keeping score. The reason this came to my attention was a story where this young guy who was 26 was deported, and because we don't have direct flights to Moscow, the U.S. has to do it through, you know, Morocco or Egypt, and hands them over to their authorities, and this poor guy was trying to hide in the men's room of the Cairo airport and was basically dragged, kicking and screaming, by the Egyptian officials back onto this deportation plane where he was chained to his seat and, you know, wept all the way from Cairo to Moscow. And passengers were sitting there. I mean, those passengers were probably just people going from Cairo to Moscow, because unfortunately, anybody who was deported with him would not have the opportunity now to tell us what happened because they're in prison.
I mean, what happened to our great American history of harboring dissidents and those that are fleeing persecution?
Well, that's gone. I mean, it's astonishing, actually, also because it was such a sort of Republican core value back in the Reagan days and the Cold War days. So to see them sort of callously say, well, we don't care as long as they're, you know, we'll take white South Africans, but that's really it. and everybody else. We don't care why you're seeking asylum, and we don't care where you go. We don't care what happens to you when you get there. It's not that nobody's given asylum. It's just that the regulations and the rules that they're using has really made it very, very difficult for people to get asylum. And once you're in that, you're in detention. It's not like you could go home and wait for your papers to arrive and tell you one way or the other, do you have asylum? You're in detention, and then bingo, you're gone.
You mentioned the Gulag 2.0. I mean, you're intimately familiar with the Gulag. Fortunately, not because you've spent any time there, but because you were the Moscow bureau chief in Russia when you were a reporter at the New York Times. What did that Gulag look like then, and what does the new one look like?
Well, when I was there was after the Soviet Union collapsed, and it was the very beginning of the Yeltsin democracy. And so they were emptying out all these prison camps in Siberia, and some of them were being turned into museums. I went to visit one that was where a lot of the Soviet dissidents had been kept and tortured. And of course, the minute Putin came into power, he said, oh, that's not a museum. Let's repurpose that as a prison. So it's the same thing all over again. And we're helping. I mean, what's nuts about it is we are at war with Russia, essentially. We're at a proxy war with Russia. We're supplying the enemy. We're doing everything we can to help Ukraine win. But we're sending back defectors from the Russian army so that they can be sent back to the army as cannon fodder. So it's not even in our interest. It's in nobody's interest.
Well, as you say, you'd want to like encourage more defectors to weaken Putin, but instead we're reinforcing that. I found your piece especially poignant because like all things, it's like, you know, oh, it's defectors. How does that really affect me? But you've got a great line in there where you said, there's a quoting from a woman who's saying, we're seeing concerted efforts to find people who have legal status and take it away. And then that's the real danger, is if the rights of refugees are trampled and we can see them as powerless, eventually, you know, the rights of others are going to follow. That really put it in perspective for when you consider it.
I think that's one of the reasons that, I mean, there's no scientific data on this, but it does anecdotally seem like more and more law school graduates are saying, I don't want to go to Wall Street. I want to work in immigration law, because they're young and they're idealistic and they don't want this to be the fate of refugees, and they don't want this to be the fate of, you know, their family, because it can come to that. I mean, that's what you were saying, right? The danger is that if you can trample on these rights that we've considered sacred, really, because they've been on the books for so long, then, you know, who's next?
It's sacred. And also, it was that, as you know, that thing with the Republicans and all of America. It's like, if someone said they want to defect, our representatives say, we got you on this. Now, like, you can't promise, like, you can't see anyone in the field promising that and knowing they can deliver on it.
I think of Russians particularly because I know the country so well, but that was such a beacon of hope for in Soviet times and even in Putin times. I don't think that they thought that if they made it all the way to the United States, they would not only be turned away, but then sent back to the place that's going to put them in prison. I mean, it's bad for everybody, right? It's bad for Salvadorans. It's bad for Mexicans. It's bad for everybody who's being deported. But I took a special interest in this because it just seems so counterintuitive.
I mean, but Alessandra, is this just one further point of evidence in the fact that this seems to be the hallmark of Trump's governing strategy? Nonsense?
Yes.
Okay. Well, if we can't make sense of it, then nobody else can.
I mean, there's no part of the Justice Department that hasn't been, I won't say ruined, but filled with. And this is just another one. But, you know, you can look at anything else. I mean, look at the protests and how they're being, I don't even want to go into ICE and the National Guard and everything else, but this is not an anomaly. This is exactly a defining theme of the Trump administration. So I'm glad to see that there are people who are standing up against it, including us.
I mean, Alessandra, as a Russia expert, you're on intimate terms with totalitarianism. I mean, you have always been very measured in terms of the Trump administration. I mean, remember when he was elected again, you said we would survive this. Do you still feel that way?
Oh, yeah, we're going to survive this, but it's going to be very damaging, and it's going to take a lot of work to repair that damage. I just don't think that this can continue, and I don't think that he can continue for very long, and I don't think that his would-be heirs are going to be able to continue it. But, I could be wrong.
Well, thank you for being a dissident. If you end up in a Salvadorian prison, Michael and I will come rescue you. We're ready.
Thank you. Bye.
Michael, I know you've been following absolutely every development out of Paris Fashion Week.
Always.
Well, Messika, one of our favorite high jewelry houses, celebrated its 20th anniversary with a spectacular show at the Musée des Arts Décoratifs.
That's a very cool idea for a jewelry designer. What was it like?
Well, it's actually their fifth show. They even had a special opening performance by Youssef Nador for the occasion. The collection was inspired by Southern Africa and showcased an array of colored stones, a first for Messika. The jewelry was shown on models who walked the runway, and some were wearing pieces pieces that were designed in collaboration with fashion designers Feben and Vignate.
Sounds like a wonderful way to celebrate for founder Valerie Masika, who launched her brand back in 2005. And a star group of guests, including Carla Bruni, Eva Herzegova, were there to take it all in.
Indeed. Learn more and experience the High Jewelry Collection at masika.com. Michael, like, just when you thought that ICE couldn't get more horrifying, there we have it.
Yeah, I mean, it's a sobering view from Alexander this week, for sure.
Did you go to any of the No Kings protests last weekend?
I was unable to. Did you?
I did. I went to the one in my hometown of Wichita, Kansas, and it was very heartening because I think it was like 57% of the state voted for Trump, and there were quite a few people there. It was encouraging. Okay, Michael, after all of that, I think we need to get very, very far away from this world that we inhabit. Perhaps Newfoundland?
Yeah, a nice remote island out in the North Atlantic. Let's do it.
John von Southern, who's a Paris-based writer, traveled all the way to the far reaches of the earth when reporting this story on a masterpiece that's been hidden in plain sight for over 200 years. John is a writer, a frequent contributor to Airmail, as well as the author of Monsieur Mediocre. Welcome, John.
Well, thanks for having me, guys.
John, your story takes us all the way to the far reaches of the earth in St. John's, Nova Scotia, where one of the great masterpieces of sculpture has been hiding kind of in plain sight for the past 200 years. Tell us a little bit about the Veiled Virgin.
Well, the Veiled Virgin is a sculpture by an Italian artist named Giovanni Strazza. People aren't sure when it was created, but I think it's around 1850, 1851. And the Veiled Virgin is kind of what the title says. It's a one piece of marble cut to such lengths and with such a virtuosity that it looks like a veiled covering of the face, and yet it's cut from one piece of marble. Veiled sculptures are kind of considered like the Vermeers in the art world. You know, they're very rare just because you need a masterful person to kind of pull this off. And the ones that exist are in major museums and metropolises, you know, throughout the world. There's one in Rome, one in Naples, one in England, one in France, one in the Vatican. And yet there was one that I discovered that is on the far-flung reaches of Newfoundland in a little town called St. John's, in a convent run by sisters of the Presentation Convent. And it's been there for almost 200 years. My piece was kind of like, how did this happen? Why is it there? And why doesn't anybody know about it? Not even the people there know about it.
How did you find out about this? Because, I mean, like you said, none of us had ever even heard of this thing, and yet somehow you got wind of it.
Yeah, well, I was in Naples a couple years ago, and I was fascinated by the Veiled Christ, which is was done by another noted Italian sculptor. I think his name is Monti. And that was in a basilica with lines down the block, and it's a must-see if you go to Naples. And I was just kind of like studying them afterwards, and I was like, well, there's this one here, and there's one there, and that's been accounted for. And then, did you know that there's one that might be the best of them all? And it's in a tiny convent in Newfoundland. And that kind of just struck my interest. I've always been interested in the art world, you know, because it's always been rife with stories of lost masterpieces suddenly found. Like, we had one here in Toulouse, France, where a Caravaggio was discovered in an attic by the owners who were there to kind of fix the leak of their roof. You have examples of masterpieces that were considered done by underlings. There was the Salvador Mundi piece that was always considered kind of a dirty tableau done by Leonardo da Vinci's underling. And then it was cleaned up and discovered that no, da Vinci himself did it. And it sold at auction for $450 million. So what intrigued me about this is that it was never lost. It's not fake. And it wasn't stolen. It's just been there in an improbable place owned by an improbable owner. So I kind of wanted to find out what's going on.
So who is that improbable owner, and who originally got that statue all the way to Newfoundland?
The name of the owner is the Presentation Convent, and it's a convent of sisters associated with the Basilica of St. John's. And I think I was one of the first journalists to ever meet with them or sit down with them. And I sat down with Sister Marilyn Doyle, who's kind of the resident expert on the Veiled Virgin. And she gave me the rundown of how I got to her, or how I got to the convent. And it all started with the Bishop of Newfoundland. They had created the basilica in St. John's. And once they finished construction, they wanted to fit out the interior. And when you fit out the interior, you go to Europe and you start buying stuff, you know, as you would a couch or anything for your new apartment. And so Mullick goes over to Europe and he goes on a buying spree and he goes down to Rome to visit the Pope, because that's what bishops did. That was part of the protocol. And there he discovered this piece that somehow was for sale. and bought it, shipped it. It arrived in Newfoundland like a couple years later or something like that. Then instead of putting it in the church, though, Mullick, he changed his mind, or he had misgivings, or he was influenced by his sister, who was a nun in the convent next door. And he said, you know what, I'm going to give it to my sister and honor her. I'm going to give it to the convent instead. And so it sat in the convent. And I talked to Sister Marilyn, and I was like, well, did the convent show off the sculpture during the time? And she said, things were different back then, and the convent was very closed off. So for 150 years, she said, nobody saw the Veiled Virgin except for the sisters and the people that worked in the monastery. And until recently, they started giving viewings. That's kind of where we are now.
John, what's great is, I mean, you sort of like recount, you took the long train, the long ferry, the long sort of like made your own little pilgrimage there. It took you more than a couple of days to get there. And then you sort of end up in that little waiting room, and you're ushered in, and here's this masterpiece just sitting in this by itself. But yeah, I was struck as well that you said, you know, that there might be a missing Strazza out there somewhere else. You said, speaking of sort of art mysteries, right?
Yeah, Strazza, he's very interesting in a weird way. Like, he's very defined by this one piece. You could almost call him a one-hit wonder, except for the poor thing, the wonder has been missing for 200 years. But he did work on different projects. And one of them I found out is that the Cairo Marriott has a couple of the Strazzas, just because I think he was a working artist at the time. He did a lot of work on commission. One of his clients, I think, was the king of Egypt, who wanted some Strazzas for his palace. And then that palace became the Marriott Hotel eventually. You can find some Strazzas right in the lobby there. He may have also been a victim of his time. As with the contemporaries like Monti, who were a little more in vogue at the time, his realist style became outdated, and he found himself kind of replaced by the futurist movement that kind of swept up Italy around the 1860s, 1870s. So maybe that would lead to why he isn't as known as his contemporaries. But now people are starting to look at this statue, the Veiled Virgin, as the best of the veiled statues, just because there's something super exquisite about this one compared to the others. One of people I spoke with, a professor at the Louvre, said that the way that she looks downwards captures both the grace and the beauty of Mary more than the others. There was a way that Strazza sculpted the marble in such a way that outside light can kind of almost pierce the first couple millimeters of the parts of the veil, to give it a sort of a luminescence, the way it kind of touches the chin, almost like it hangs on her, and the way she's looking down, that kind of adds to just the, I don't know, the grace of the subject. At least that's what I've been told. And it really was. I think actually having done the long trip and having gone to such extent to see this thing and going up the stairs of the convent and just ringing the buzzer and seeing the fax machine and filling out the visitor's log, and then just actually walking into this oratory type tiny room with little lighting, and Sister Marilyn walking you through the story, you know, I broke down. I started crying because it was just such a beautiful piece and nobody knows about it. And I think that's what was so fascinating, that the people I spoke to in St. John's in around Newfoundland, I stayed there for a week, nobody had even known that it was there. You know, it was kind of like having a Rothko sitting in the middle of Plano, Texas, and nobody in Plano, Texas knows it's there, you know, and yet it's open to the public. Every day you can go see it. And what I loved about the convent is that it's a working convent. You know, you go, you pass through a parking lot. There's a soup kitchen off to the right. They're doing the good deeds that the convent was made for. And if you want to go and see a masterpiece that's sitting in the oratory, well, you're welcome to go there as well.
Well, John, thank you so much for this beautiful story and for sharing it with us today.
Well, thank you guys. I appreciate it. If any art aficionados, intrepid travelers want to go, it's at the Presentation Convent, you know, Monday through Friday. Sister Marilyn's ready to give you the tour. All you have to do is just leave a little donation.
The dream. John, thanks again.
There's only one place to discover a global snapshot of the current cultural scene. AIRMEL's Arts Intel Report. Our international research tool for what to do and where and when to do it is user-friendly, continuously updated, and meticulously curated. Arts Intel is handy at home, on the road, and when you're planning your next trip. It also includes indispensable lists of restaurants and hotels in key cities around the world, recommended by our well-traveled experts. Explore Arts Intel at airmail.news/arts-intel, and be sure to sign up for our Week in Culture newsletter, which is published every Wednesday afternoon at airmail.news/WIC. I'm Chris Garrett, AIRMEL Deputy Editor, and I never leave home without it. Bon voyage.
have to say, Michael, these are the kind of stories I live for. When John filed this, I was like in a state of bliss for several days. You know, it combines everything that we love, right? Travel, art, things you've never heard about but are curious about, the full joy of human life.
Yeah, it's brilliant. I remember him telling me he was on his way there and taking the ferry overnight for 20 hours and, you know, then a train and blah, blah, blah. But really made the pilgrimage, and it's a beautiful story.
He's the best. Well, Michael, speaking of the best, it is the weekend. Lord knows we need a bit of a break from the realities of life. What do you have to recommend to us?
Have you watched the new season of The Diplomat yet?
No, I've been in New York too busy hanging out with you to watch TV.
Oh my gosh.
Sorry.
Okay, well, I'm not gonna spoil it. I'm going to say that I'm, what, 4 episodes in? And I turned to Brooke after episode 3 and I said, I think that might have been one of the great hours of TV, just to see episode 3 alone. The season is fantastic. Carrie Russell, Rufus Sewell, everyone's great. Allison Janney's because the president. And I think that the writing and the plot twists are super great. So I can't wait to finish them. I got, as I said, this season to episode 4, but now I'm sort of like, because I want to just make it last a little longer. But brilliant season. You can watch it, catch up. We'll talk about it next week. But for the rest of everyone, if you don't know, it's The Diplomat, Carrie Russell, Rufus Sewell, and it's streaming right now on Netflix. And you, my dear?
Okay. I saw After the Hunt, the new Luca Guadagnino film.
With Julia Roberts.
Oh, honey, Julia Roberts is just the beginning. I mean, a memorable role from Chloe Sevigny. Andrew Garfield's fabulous in it. Yeah, I loved it. Do you like his films?
I go in and out with him.
A lot of people say this to me. Look, for the art direction and costumes alone, I'm a huge fan. And in this, you know, there's a lot to like about this film. You know, it starts Julia Roberts as a professor at Yale who becomes embroiled in a Me Too scandal. And she has to confront her relationship with one of her prize students who is a bit of a nepo baby and a complicated character in and of herself. But it's a really thoughtful, interesting take, not only on the Me Too movement and how it's playing out on universities, but also on the generational divide that is in many ways defining American life right now. And also the extreme wealth that has populated this country and how, you know, the haves and have nots and the aspirants have such different paths to success. So anyway, I thought it was a really well done, interesting film. Also incredibly beautiful. I mean, the apartment that Julia Roberts lives in, presumably in New Haven, is spectacular, Michael. It like gave me all sorts of tile ideas for my bathroom. I just love the way that it's designed. And Julia Piersanti, who is the costume designer for a lot of Guadagnino's films, did a great job in this too. So if you see me now wearing white jeans year round with my black loafers, you will know who to blame.
Well, I'm sure you look good at doing it.
Oh, by the way, have you seen the new Downton Abbey movie? New-ish now?
No.
Oh, you have to see it in the theater. It's so good. I saw it for the second time, actually. Don't ask why. It's really wonderful. If you love the show, you need to see it. Downton Abbey, the final chapter. Julian Fellowes at his finest. Highly recommend.
I'll do it. Thank you.
All right. Well, wishing you all a glorious weekend full of lots of movie going and television watching. We'd like to thank our sponsor, Masika. Michael, will you please read us out?
Morning Meeting is produced by Airplay Productions and edited by Jesse Cannon. Our co-editors are Graydon Carter and Alexander Stanley. Our chief operating officer is Bill Keenan, and our deputy editors are Ashley Baker, Chris Gaird, Nathan King, Julie Vitale, and Ash Carter. CMO's Emily Davis, and our music supervisor is Randall Poster. Our theme music is The Cute Monster by the Buddy Collette Quintet. A new edition of AirMail is published every Saturday, so please subscribe and enjoy all our stories on airmail.news, which we update every day. You can also find us on Twitter and Instagram at AirMail Weekly. We will be back here next Saturday with another edition of Morning Meeting. In the meantime, be sure to subscribe at Spotify or Apple Music. But most of all, thank you again for joining us.